This program is a production of the LA Sound Posse and is dedicated to the public domain. Please feel free to copy and share it, thus becoming yourself part of a decentralized civic media. The following is a presentation by Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh, entitled Investigating the War on Terrorism. This talk was delivered at University of California, Santa Barbara, October 10th, 2004.
And now it's my pleasure to do the actual introduction, to introduce to you David Obst. David Obst is a local Santa Barbaran these days. He's a journalist, literary agent, and producer who helped break Cy Hirsch's Pulitzer Prize-winning story about the My Lai massacre. He was involved with bringing the Pentagon Papers to light, working with Daniel Ellsberg. He was a literary agent for many years with Watergate-era books, including John Dean's Blind Ambition, and Bob Woodard and Carl Bernstein's All the President's Men. He's the author of Too Good to Be Forgotten, Changing America in the 60s and 70s. He's currently retired, but he also was a film producer, did a script for a film called Revenge of the Nerds. Please welcome David Obst.
Thank you. Look at all the people. This is just so great that this many people show up for Cy. And I urge you all to come tomorrow and hear Chris Hedges. It's going to be equally riveting. I first met Cy in 1969. I was just out of college and trying to stop the war and had a little anti-war news service called Dispatch. And Cy had been with the Associated Press and had left and had just written a book on chemical biological warfare. And we were both kind of at loose ends during the day because neither of us had real jobs and played tennis. And a friend in the Pentagon tipped us off to this, as the Pentagon cited it, a killing of 116 Oriental human beings. And Cy went after it with his normal tenacity and just nailed the story. And it became a seminal moment in that period, in that for the first time it was possible for America to freeze frame the horror of that war and see what a toll it was taking, not only on the women and children who were thrown into ditches and brutally shot, but also on these poor American boys who were kind of yanked out of small towns and given the most modern weaponry and said, go over there and defend your country. I'll just tell one quick story and then I'll let Cy come out here. Cy had found this poor, unfortunate fellow named Paul Meadlow in Terre Haute, Indiana, who was willing to go public with the fact that he had, in fact, shot into these ditches. And we realized we had been in the newspapers with two prior stories, and the story was beginning to percolate, but we realized that for something to really happen in America and be valid, it has to be on television. So we gave CBS News an exclusive on interviewing Paul Meadlow. Meanwhile, a Dispatch News Service, which I was running, sent the story out with an embargo for the next morning's newspapers, and we were holed up in New York where Paul was going to go on that evening and be interviewed by Mike Wallace. And we suddenly get a phone call in my hotel room, and it's Abe Rosenthal, who's the executive editor of the New York Times. And he says, nice story, kids, but we are the paper of record, and we'd kind of like to send over one of our people. Now, Cy, unfortunately, was in the room, and kind of when I said, it's Abe Rosenthal, he kind of went over and he put his ear against the phone. He heard that, and he grabbed the phone away from him, and he says, you're the paper of record? Well, Mr. Rosenthal, Paul Meadlow's somewhere in New York. Find him. gets better. He calls right back, and he says, "Do you know who I am?" And Cy says, "Yep," and hangs up on him. So I'd like to introduce to you a living legend, a national treasure, and somebody we all should be proud to know, Seymour Hersh.
Thank you. You know, the story about Paul Meadlow, he is the kid, and the other part about him is he was among those who executed, he was firing into a ditch, and it emerged. The interview was with Mike Wallace, and out of it emerged a wonderful poster that it was a picture of one of the victims in My Lai in the ditch, untold numbers. All women, children, and old men. And there was a cut line from the interview. Women and children, too. Yes, women and children. And the next day, when they shot everybody in the ditch, Mila was one. Most of the Hispanic and African-American kids shot up. They weren't about not to shoot because they knew the consequences of not going along could be very deleterious to them. But they weren't going to shoot those people, and they shot up in the air. And you had a case where the minority people in the services wore for weeks. They wore little armbands to signify their disagreement with it. But in any case, what happened was that somehow one of the mothers had tucked one of the kids, a little boy about two, under her stomach, and somehow he survived all the bullets that were being fired by the farm boys like Paul Meadlow. And so there was a moment when everything was quiet, and I will tell you, they were eating their lunch by the ditch, their K rations, and all of a sudden they heard some noise, and the kid crying, beginning crying louder and louder, crawled his way to the top and began to run, crawled out of the ditch. And Lieutenant William Calley, sort of infamous, he's the Linda England, you know, the girl with the thumbs up and thumbs down, sort of the one person we seem to think is responsible, or people want us to think that. I'm talking about the girl in Abu Ghraib, the bad seed. Anyway, at one point, and so Callie said to Meadlow, "Plug him." And Meadlow couldn't do it when it was one person. And so Callie, officers had carbines in the Vietnam War. The enlisted guys had M1s. So he took his carbine and ran behind the kid and shot him, put his gun, and shot him dead. And the next day, Meadlow had his leg blown off. David's reminding about all this when he mentioned all this stuff. He had his leg blown off, and as they were medevacing him out, he was screaming, "God's punished me, Cal, and he's going to punish you too." So anyway, I'm chasing this story down, and David had the news service. The reason I was dealing with David, not that he's not a nice guy, and we played pickup basketball all the time, not that he's not a nice guy and a good basketball player, but nobody else would buy the story, even though, as he said, I'd covered the war for the AP. I'd been Senator Eugene McCarthy's press secretary and speechwriter in the campaign, the famous Children's Crusade against Lyndon Johnson. And I'd written this was 1969 in the fall. In September of 69, I had the lead article in the New York Times magazine. I'd written for Life magazine. I was a young freelance writer making it in Washington. And I knew everybody, you know. I knew all the people, and I still couldn't get the story published. So we were doing the story serially in the New York, in the Dispatch News Service, and eventually I found, after the second week, I found a list of the people in the company, all a company roster from a Thanksgiving Day dinner before they went to Vietnam, and that's when I found, I knew about Meadlow, and I tracked him down, M-E-A-D-L, it's one of those great names, it's easy to find, even before Google and all those things you can do on a computer, you can find him. And he lived in a town called New Goshen, Indiana, which was outside of Terre Haute, which is outside of Indianapolis, which is somewhere in America. You know? what the West Coast people call flyover, you know. And so, his mother was, I don't know where his father was, if he had one, but I called and got to his mother, and he agreed through her to see me, so I was coming anyway. I said, "Look, even if you don't want to see you, I'm just going to sit outside your house, and so you better talk to me. You know, not in a threatening way, you can't do that, but I'm just in a persistent way." So I get there, And she's out of a Norman Rockwell, you know, post-World War II painting. It's a chicken farm. She's grizzled, leathery skin, small. And he's inside, and she meets me, and I say, I'm here to talk to him. And she says, quote, unquote, she said, I gave them a good boy, and they sent me back a murderer. One of those lines you can never forget. And so I'll tell you a little bit about this war. Just in general, you have to know, this war is like, I don't know, one of the analogies I make, I keep on thinking, when I think about, well, there's a great Richard Pryor bit where he's in bed doing the best friend of his wife, and she walks in, the wife walks in and starts screaming, and he says, no, 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 he says to her, he says, this isn't what it seems. He said, I'm not doing it. He said, now, are you going to believe me or your lying eyes? And this is essentially the George Bush position on the war. Well, I'll get back to that because, you know, he is in a position where he says, it's sort of an amazing position we're in this society, where he says, we're doing great, we're going to win, and it doesn't matter what we see every day and what the reports tell us and what we hear. It doesn't matter. It's just, you know, that's got a lot of pretty serious implications. So let me tell you before I get... the thing about Bush that's scary to me, and I've been, you know, as some of you know, I've been doing alternative history of the war for 3 years in the New Yorker, and only because over, you know, 30 years or 40 years, I know people inside, and there is trouble, the good ones, there is trouble. You do understand that everybody wants to do their job right, whether they're the FBI, the CIA, or a three-star general, they want to do their job right. Nobody's interested in the destruction and chaos that's going on out there. Not, I mean, there are some, of course, who support it, but most of the people in the military, the sensible ones, the officers, are very troubled. But here's the thing about Bush that's amazing. He does believe this is an appropriate war and a just war. The real question for me is, how did 8 or 9 neoconservatives, I'm talking about Wolfowitz and a guy named I. Lewis Libby and a guy named Hadley who works in the White House, and Richard Pearl, they're intellectuals in the sense that they understand neoconservatism. It comes from the disarray inside the pro-communist movement after Stalin proved to be so horrible, and they split. Dwight MacDonald, some of you know about it, and there was various socialist party fights, and there was a long-standing intellectual issue. The neocons come out of sort of the notion that we really can't trust a liberal democracy to take care of itself, et cetera, et cetera. But Bush wasn't one. He's not intellectual anyway. He's not that he's dumb. He's not dumb. He's just not intellectual. He doesn't think that way. Neither does Cheney and neither does Rumsfeld. So what you've had is 8 or 9 neoconservatives that somehow, after 9/11, obviously, persuaded this president in this most remarkable leap of logic, which is the path to defeating international terrorism must run through Baghdad. And it's an amazing sort of gap. And I'm telling you, the big fight, for example, in 2002, and I'm talking to people inside it, and the big fight was force, how much to go. Bush wanted to go. He was, by February, if we ever got an honest history, which is hard to do, it's hard to do now. Maybe we'll get papers later. I'd say by the latest March of 2002, he was done. He was in there. You want to talk about UN, you want to talk about other stuff, he's going. This is it. And he was persuaded by the neoconservatives, as I said, about the rightness of it. And the fight for all during 2002 was not about whether we're going to go, it was about how much. And the military, particularly the Marines are interesting because they'll go in the Fallujah hand-to-hand and go after the bad guys, and the lance corporals will get the blood up, and they'll try and kill everybody. That's what they do. I mean, that's when you wind them up, they go. But they're the ones that are the most interested in knowing before they go what's the lay of the land, and they're the toughest that can sell on an operation. And they went in this war over their dead body, and they were resistant all the way. So the fight's over about forces. And what Bush, if you remember a guy named General Wayne Downing, had been involved in running the Delta Force during the first Gulf War in 91. Downing was in the White House, and Downing was among those true believers who thought we could go in and with 15,000 troops, give or take a few, some special forces, a little bombing, and a lot of American flags, lay them down, and Saddam would fold, a new government magically would appear. There's no evidence that, you know, I think the Milosevic model might have been with the model they had, some of them who thought about it. I just don't know where the new government's going to come from. And democracy would spread, as I've been saying in interviews, like water out of fountains, not only through Iraq, Baghdad, and Iraq. Of course, it would go into Syria and Iran, Saudi Arabia, and what they always call the neoconservatives, occupied Lebanon. They don't like Syria and its influence there. So, and this was the idea. And so I'm here to tell you, it really wasn't about oil or Israel, although they would all come out well in this. Once democracy was established in this region of the world, the Palestinians would see the futility. They'd lose their supporters. You know, the evil empires in Iraq and Syria, et cetera, support the Palestinians. Once we exchanged those for democratic societies, the Palestinians would realize their cause was hopeless and they would sue for peace. This is one of the theories. And oil, of course, would be protected because you didn't have to have American companies taken over, but friendly European, other countries would run it, and oil would flow. We'd protect the oil flow. And, of course, if we could do something, the neocons always want to do something about the Saudis because they don't trust them. They want that oil, too. But that's all possible. The world would be a better place. And it's utopian. It's idealistic, maybe, if you want to put a word that Bush wouldn't know much about. It's a Trotskyite. It's a, you know, it's a believer in permanent revolution, you know, as Trotsky did. I mean, it's that. And, of course, it's completely, utterly wrong. And doesn't work and isn't going to work, and it's absolutely it's the wrongest calculation and the grossest mistake you could make, and he doesn't believe it. He doesn't know it, and he doesn't believe it. Therefore, this is not a man to say he did it for oil. I would say, great, there's some mechanism there that's going to enable him. Hey, listen, you know what I advise people to do? You know, I spoke to some lawyers who could afford it. I said, look, you guys can afford it. Here's what you do. They said, what do? I said, just buy property in Tuscany. That's what I say. Because I'm telling you, let's assume he gets reelected. Okay? Now, we have to think beyond it. You have to think beyond it. Hey, excuse me. In my day, a liberal wasn't somebody Bush called Kerry a liberal. Let's see, Kerry's foreign policy is we can win the war in Iraq, which, of course, is unwinnable. I'm going to increase the armed forces. I'm going to train the Iraqi soldiers to this magical force that will never do it. And I'm going to do something about Iran. I'm going to pressure Iran. This is a liberal platform. I mean, in most of the days, we'd call this a, you know, I'll take it. Because we don't have many chips, you know, in this. But to get back to Bush, and you see, for Bush, if he wins the election, what he's going to do is escalate, because we can't win the war. The war is unwinnable. And this isn't me talking. These are my friends. We've never been able to penetrate the insurgency. In the early days, the insurgency were 2- and 3-man groups, and now they're 10-, 15-man groups. We still don't know. If they're going to do a car bombing that's going to kill 7 Marines, that has happened a few weeks ago, we'll know about it after the fact. We cannot beat the insurgency. Alawi, although he got a standing O from the U.S. Congress, Alawi was a member of the Mukhabarat, the secret police of Iraq. And when Saddam went to power, basically by burrowing his way inside the Ba'ath Party in the 60s and into the 70s, murdering his way into power, and he had two big helpers, a general named Shakur, who later ran the Mukhabarat, and Alawi was right there. He was an inside guy. He's a what they call a white Shiite, a non-religious Shiite. And Alawi then, it was some dispute. Everybody tells me it wasn't about ideology, it was about money or something. He ends up in London going to med school. I don't know if he ever finished it. We call him doctor, but there's no evidence he practiced. And he becomes their field man for years against anybody in the diaspora, anybody outside of Iraq that's an opponent of Saddam. And he turns after there's a dispute, they try and kill him with axes. And he turns, and for the next 20 years, while his fellow Shiites are getting mauled and beaten up and suppressed by Saddam, he's living, you know, a Seville Row in London, taking money from us, MI6, the British, taking money from the Israeli intelligence. He's dealing with everybody. And so he has, and the first thing he does when he gets into power, of course, is he thanks the Americans and makes it clear he has no standing, none. There's no way this government can work. And I'll tell you, I don't want to rag on my peers in the press corps. It's you know, if I'm asked about the press, I usually say I'm not interested in self-immolation. I want to avoid dealing with the press. But since he's been in power, I will tell you that there has been an exponential increase in air sorties, We have been bombing the brains out of that place. There's never been one report from this Pentagon or this White House about the number of sorties. There's never been any accounting whether they've increased or not, how much tonnage is being dropped, where is it being dropped, nor is there any requirements or demands by the press for it. We read every day more bombings. How many times have we gone into Fallujah to go after the mythical Zarqawi? It probably doesn't exist. Most people in the intel community tell me. We've done 12, 13 missions, and each time there's never any evidence that anybody close to Zarqawi is killed. Why would a Jordanian have any influence with the insurgency anyway? Jordanians are not Iraqis. They're not members of the insurgency, but that's another issue. But at each occasion after we bomb Fallujah, Al Jazeera does wonderful footage of rescue workers digging out children limb by limb. And, why is there insurgency? Some of the bombs we drop have a kill radius of 400 meters. And so we're doing that, and it's all right in front of us. We don't even know how many artillery shells. We don't know. There's been a massive escalation. So if Bush is elected, since he cannot win the war, it's unwinnable. It's the wrong nomenclature. Why is it unwinnable? In a simple sentence, we are the 200-octane. We, the U.S. of America, are the 200-octane fuel that keeps it going. The hatred for us is so acute. It's not about outside agitators. I'm sure there's some. This is about indigenous day-by-day reality of what happens when an occupier has a lot of force and uses it indiscriminately, as in inevitably. It's the lesson the French learned with the Viet Minh, and we didn't learn with the Vietnamese. And I'll tell you something else that's troubling about... I'm not trying to bring you all down, folks. I'm not selling uppers. It's... Bush is elected. The only thing he can do, he's got to keep up Alawi. He's got to prop it up. And so he's got to bomb. He's got to escalate. The old classic line that came out of Vietnam, remember there was Peter Arnett once asked an army major who was shelling a village to the smithereens in Vietnam, South Vietnam, why are you bombing it so much? And he said, we have to destroy it in order to save it, he said. It's one of the great iconic lines of the Vietnam War. And so, you have to remember something about Vietnam. Vietnam, 58,000 Americans dead, 2 to 3 million Vietnamese, was always a tactical war in the sense that our strategic interests were never threatened, our national security. Within a few years of the war, the Vietnamese, as the Japanese did, there's a wonderful book written by a guy, Gower, I think, Enduring Freedom, or Embracing Defeat. I think it won a Pulitzer Prize about 10 years ago, a Harvard historian about how the Japanese turned on a dime from being ready to die against us after the war. They turned. Perhaps it's the same cultural thing in the Asian. I don't know. I don't mean to be light about it or even racist, and assuming they're the same. But basically, within a few years, there's no question that the Vietnamese wanted representation. They now, it's a burgeoning society, tourist spot. We go there, hotels, the gamut, a lot of friendship, a lot of trade. With the war in Iraq, that is a strategic war. We have put ourselves into a strategic war with 1.4 billion Muslims. This is not going to be so easy to extract. And some of those societies in Afghanistan, some of the Pashtun, not Muslim nonetheless, but still different societies, three generations is an appropriate time to wait for revenge in the Pashtun society, 50 years. They'll get the son of your son. This is not just mythical stuff. It's serious. So it's a different war. It's a strategic war. I'm not sure how much they know in the White House. One of the things I was knocked out about was I read very carefully the Woodward book, the first one in particular, because he had access to everything, Bob Woodward. And there's 300-400 pages of all the notes of the White House, all the minutes. And in those 400 pages, there's never a sentence or in a meeting where at the National Security Council or with the president, somebody says, so what's this about Muslims? And what about this Quran thing? Maybe I'll take a look at it, What does it mean? The assumption was everybody was against us in that world because they wanted what we had. That's the working assumption. I mean, it's on that primitive level. I'm just quoting the book. I mean, that's the book. There was no indication of any serious thinking about that world. We had Bernard Lewis and his tracts, which are all mostly very anti-Muslim. And I would argue with you that he's very close to the neoconservatives and one of their mentors. And if go read it again, you'll see how limited in scope and provocative it is, like the hunting and stuff, clash of cultures. The suggestion that it's inevitable that we're going to be in a conflict with the Muslim world, which strikes me as really nuts, particularly since so much of the Muslim world so many people in the Muslim world had respect. When 9/11 happened, the Muslim world opened up its books to us. Countries that never were helpful to us, Sudan, Yemen, across the third world countries were pouring in. The Syrians offered us all their intelligence, which we took, a lot of stuff from the Syrians. The evil Iranians, who are, of course, are Sunni, Shiite, who don't like the Sunni al-Qaeda, the evil Iranians worked with us very closely in the first 4 or 5 months of the war in Afghanistan. They blocked they blocked al-Qaeda from fleeing out of Afghanistan from our attacks into what would be eastern Iran. And so we had a lot of cooperation from people that we absolutely threw away by going into Iraq. And we don't, you know, this is all macro stuff. Let me get you down to the micro level. The Paul Meadow level. I did all this stuff on Abu Ghraib for The New Yorker. And in part, one of the reasons I got into it, CBS didn't do it. I had learned about Abu Ghraib. One of the things I did is I pay a lot of attention to the United Nations inspection team in the process. And they do a lot of reports. And once the war is underway, it doesn't take... I'm not Uriah Heeping you. You don't have to be a rocket scientist to know that if you're looking for people who are not Iraqis who understand that country, the United Nations inspection team, those guys like Scott Ritter is one of the guys who might be on some of your names, and there's a whole bunch of other guys. There were Russians, there were Australians, there were Brits. Most of them had intelligence background like Scott did. I mean, Scott did a lot of intelligence work in his life. They spent from 1991 to 1998, when they finally left, they left. They weren't thrown out. They left before Bill Clinton bombed. If you remember, he bombed Baghdad with tomahawks in December of 1998. The same area, by the way, looking for Saddam, trying to assassinate him. The same area, exactly the same part of Baghdad that Bush bombed in March, right before the war in March of 2003. Same bad intelligence, same bad, you know, they were conned both times. Anyway, where was I? And, what? Macro, yeah, all right. There's something else I was going to say. What? You're doing, everything's interesting no matter whether it's connected from one thing to another. That's how starved you are for information. Abu Ghraib takes place. Well, look, it's too late for you. For 30 minutes, you haven't heard me. You're just speaking out now. Have you been able to hear me back there? I mean, I don't know. Maybe we're a passive society. This is why you can get away with it so much. You know, so I do the Abu Ghraib stuff in The New Yorker. And in May of this year, and a couple of weeks later, I get a call from a mother. And here's her story. Her daughter had been in the military police unit that she later learned. She didn't know where she was, but she knew she was serving in a prison in Baghdad. And she came back after a year's duty or 6 months or 9 months duty. The reserve unit was sent back. In March of 2004, after it was reported, but before it became public. And somebody remind me, put this, you know, chronology in my head. But anyway, and so here's their story. It's a phone conversation. I go see her because people always talk better when you see them or more willingly. The daughter comes back, sullen, withdrawn, was married, left her husband, left the home, moved into an apartment by herself. I think I would describe, this was a very religious woman, lower middle class, I guess we'd say. The daughter went into reserves to get some money so she could maybe go on to pay for college. We're talking about junior, local, two-year community college, whatever. A small town in an eastern state. And so the daughter comes back. I'd use the word depressed, but, you know, I can't make a judgment like that. But it sounds like she was in real bad trouble. And also then begins going and starts getting black tattoos all over her body, which drives her mother crazy. She's almost every weekend, another black tattoo. Come the Abu Ghraib stuff, and she begins to understand the daughter. She understands her daughter was in Abu Ghraib, okay? Daughter won't talk about it, but she admits it's door slamming. more sullenness. And so she had done what a lot of mothers did and fathers before the war. When a kid went off, they gave laptops to kids because it had DVDs so the kids on duty could watch movies. You know, we don't ever want to be too far from our media, right? And so it was a second computer, but she says it was just inadvertent. I don't think so. I think it's, you know, Freud lives or whatever. And she went and got the computer. And this is after the stories about Abu Ghraib and after the daughter acknowledged she was there. And she starts looking through the files. She said she was cleaning files, but I don't believe that either. And she finds the file marked Iraq and opens it. And it's these. It's like, I mean, I don't know what a mother would feel seeing those pictures. These were more dogs, only the dogs. If you remember, the New Yorker ran a photograph of the man naked, hands like this, two dogs snarling. Well, the dogs did bite. And these are pictures of blood and dogs and sensitive parts that were bitten. And you have to understand, we've had a long colloquy in the various investigations, all of which were carefully leaked this summer by the Pentagon before the Republican convention. There were two more investigations by Schlesinger and another general named Fay into Abu Ghraib, and all of which talked about how there were rules and regulations, and Abu Zaid finally agreed, or not Abu Zaid, he's the four-star, General Sanchez, Ricardo Sanchez, the commander, did agree that dogs could be used only with muzzles and under certain conditions. Are you kidding? There were no rules. And it's like in Vietnam, there was something known as the MGR rule, the Mer Gook rule, which was, if you went on a patrol and you suddenly murdered somebody, and the officer heard, you're an enlisted guy, and the officer heard about it, and he would say, what happened? Son, what did you do? He said, sir, just a gook, sir. Vietnamese, that's a slang word, pejorative word for the Vietnamese. That was a defense. I'm not exaggerating. The Mer Gook rule was an unwritten rule. If it was just a gook, okay. A little raping here and there, just a gook, it's okay. She was Viet Cong. And so in this case, there were no rules. And I'll tell you that when we're done, if we want to know, and there's always a big question of what we want to know, under the Supreme Court, the government has been forced to confront the fact that most of the prisoners at Guantanamo had no basis for being there. Certainly, by the Army's own count, more than 60% of the people in the prisons in Iraq had nothing to do with insurgency, had just been picked up in sweeps. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International estimate 90% had nothing to do, and all put through this prison forever. And so, I guess, in my own view, I think we're going to be mortified. I was saying earlier at lunch that Guantanamo is going to end up being our Andersonville, our Civil War prison. If some of you remember, McKinley Cantor wrote a marvelous, extremely long book about it back 30 or 40 years ago. It's going to be our horror prison. It was a Union prison for the South, and we ran in Georgia, murder place, Murder Incorporated. I think we're going to be really mortified and ashamed. So you say to yourself, so how did it happen? How do we get 8 or 9 zealots and cultists? My take, you all remember General Shinseki, the general who was, as Kerry keeps on talking about, who the army general who protested about not enough forces, and because he talked about needing 200 or 300 troops, 1,000 troops, of course he got in big trouble. I have my own sort of interpretation of it, knowing these people, I mean, writing about them, talking to a lot of people in the government that couldn't deal with them. Shinseki didn't, this is an interpretation. The real problem for Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld about Shinseki wasn't that he mentioned numbers. It's, didn't he get it? Didn't he go to those meetings in the tank, the JCS, where they would meet, the secure room for the Joint Chiefs meet? Didn't he know? We told him, this is before the war, just 5,000, 10,000, lay it down, it's all over. They're going to greet us with, you know, velvet gloves, you know what Cheney said. Didn't Shinseki understand? He was like somebody who'd been deprogrammed, you know, gone out of a, you know, and that was the complaint about him. I'm slightly exaggerating, but only slightly. We're talking about a really narrow cult that took us over. Where was the bureaucracy? Where was the Congress? Where was the press, you know, where were we? Where was the military in terms of public complaint? And there's, well. And so here we are. Kerry's problem is, that if he's elected, these people are going to be on him like leeches, make it impossible for him to govern. He's going to walk into some serious problems. The budget's in chaos. There's going to be economic problems. The war can't go anywhere, particularly if he's going to keep on pretending. I don't know what he's going to do. He's done one thing in the last month. He's sort of moved the dynamics a little bit. He's basically left it out there, so if you're for the war, vote for Bush. If you're against it, vote for me. He's not made that clear, but he's moving that way. And I don't know. I don't know the guy. I don't know him well enough to know that he seems very articulate and bright. Still pretty unlikable, but so what? We don't have to be fussy. Take it where you can get it. So will he, if he doesn't change the nomenclature, if he doesn't start talking about it's not about winning, we have to figure a way out, which is very hard. Two countries will fight us bitterly about getting out if he decides to get out. And for a totally different reason. Israel, of course, is in desperate shape, much worse shape than they'd been if this war hadn't started. They played along. They made a terrible miscalculation. They fed the psychosis in the White House, or the cultists in the White House. They fed them bad information. They hyped the game. There's an internal investigation right now in Israel about two generals may take the fall for giving bad information or going along with it. Because the truth of the matter is, Israel's real concern was much more at Iran rather than Iraq. Israel would not want us. Israel is going to be the inevitable collapse of Iraq is going to be very difficult for Israel. They're going to be faced with much more enemies, many more enemies. The other country that doesn't want us out, of course, is Iran, the big winner. Iran's the huge winner. Iran has done incredible. Iran has emerged as the most powerful country in the Middle East. The analogy for Iran and us is the Soviet Union would be us and Iran would be us in the war against the Mujahideen. In other words, we've put ourselves in the position that the Russians put themselves in Afghanistan in the 70s and during that horrible war when they retreated in the 80s. We're that much of a loser in this. And Iran, my own hunch is, again, speaking heuristically, is that my friends in the community tell me, again, about the White House. 2002, they have to sell. If they're going to do Iraq, they have to sell nuclear threat. So the White House becomes, I had a guy in the intelligence community, the hard intelligence, signal stuff. He said to me, think about Washington in the year 2002 as a reverse super thruster vacuum engine, just a reversed engine, swooshing in anything from anywhere out there that could possibly make the case that Saddam has a nuclear intention, which, by the way, no question, since 90, he was wiped out totally in 91. We can go back to Charlie Dolfer and talk about him as a digression. Charlie Dolfer is presented to you guys, the guy who wrote the report, which not only said there was nothing there in 96, he worked for the UN for all those years, there was nothing there in 96, but then he also gave this wonderful out. But if Saab, if he could have, would have, might have, would have, which was the out, and it's a little bit like I was telling Opst a minute ago, that it's a little bit like, the analogy of Saddam wanting to do it and being able to do it would be me like 20 years ago wanting to do Sheryl Stone, you know, that Sharon Stone and being able to do it, right? No way. I might want to, but I can't. And so who's Dolfer? Dolfer's presented Tavra Larissa by the press. Dolfer was the inside guy for the United States in the UN team when the UN was involved. I know what I was, when I went off the track, I was going to tell you about the UN. Guys in the UN had spent 6-7 years inside Baghdad and made friends, made great friends among the Iraqis because, hey, the world's full of nice people. Iraqis are nice people. Even if you're an officer working for Saddam, you're a nice person. And most of the people who were assigned to the UN team had self-taught themselves English, so they were much brighter. There were included a couple of generals who had done signals intelligence and other stuff who weren't picked up by us. We put everybody, it was another prison in Baghdad called Camp Cropper, where all of the senior leaders have been since March of and April of 2003 without a whimper. Nobody knows about them. We don't talk about them. Some of their family members have tried to get American lawyers to sue habeas corpus, but nobody will touch the case. They're just there. They've been there for a year and a half. It's not even on the table. 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, it's at the airbase, the international airport, the one that we took over. In any case, So through these guys, so when the war went down, one plus was there was internet, and in the beginning there was the internet. There were even internet cafes for the first month or two. Baghdad right now, the most sophisticated town, most sophisticated city, and obviously in Iraq, Baghdad has had no mail, no phones, irregular electricity. No sewage, no water since May, June of 2003. It's a complete wasteland. It's what we've done. The damage there is incalculable. Filth, the hospitals are destroyed. I mean, the litany is just beyond belief. It's a complete nightmare. But in any case, some of the guys who worked with the guys in the UN made contact. And so through my buddies in the UN, I was able to get a roster of a lot of very good guys who were inside Baghdad, inside the Ba'ath Party, didn't like Saddam. That was the judgment of people who worked with them for years. They trusted them. There was a lot of trust. And so I would go to Damascus and meet people. As a reporter, they would come out. Until just about 3 months ago, you could do that with some ease. It's too wild now. So I would meet people, and I didn't want to meet them in Iraq. I'm not into, again, suicide. And I would come out. They would come out. Taxi cab, $750. You could ride in. And we'd spend days in Damascus talking. And in December, last December, 6 months before I got anything about Abu Ghraib, one of the generals who hadn't been picked up by us, who had a little fruit stand, there's no pensions anymore, no business, told me that things were so bad in Abu Ghraib. The point I'm making is the Iraqi people didn't need me to know what's going on. Women who were in prison there were smuggling metal letters out to their family or messages to their family saying, please come and kill me because I've been defiled. And, you know, it's a culture of shame. And it's a culture where you know what happens to women when they're not pure. They're cast out. And it's the same as, you know, it's one of the interesting things about the Arab world. And so everybody knew it stunk. What made it happen, of course, were the photographs. I'll take one more riff on a digression about chronology. And let the book I wrote is about chain of command, and it's a compendium. But it begins after I did Abu Ghraib. A bunch of guys in the White House came. This had worked for Condi, and again, it's a question of integrity. The White House knew what they needed to know about the conditions of the prisoners. Of course they knew right away, but they knew explicitly because in the middle of 2002. The CIA was very upset. We had 600 prisoners from Afghanistan that were all over Guantanamo. No intelligence, no useful intelligence from them, nothing at all. And so a guy, one of these CIA operatives who knew perfect Arabic, went down there, spent a lot of time, came back, wrote a blistering report, internal report, highly classified. And one of the points in the report was he talked to 30 people, inmates, extensively without anybody else around because not many people know Arabic like he did. Many Americans, and more, he said half anyway, at least half of those had nothing to do with anything. And as he said in the report, if they weren't Al-Qaeda when we arrested them, they will be when we let them out. It's also a violation of the Geneva Convention. And then orally, he told his peers in the agency and in the White House, one of his good friends was a four-star general named John Gordon, one of these great guys that you go into a foxhole with anytime, four-star Air Force general, had worked as a deputy director of the CIA. He was a technical guy, he was a physicist. Ran the aerospace command. Just a guy, an officer who understood some basic things. One, you don't treat their prisoners any differently than you want yours to be treated. And two, that you don't get intelligence from people who want to fly buildings airplanes into your buildings to kill the infidels, us. You don't get intelligence by coercion from those people. You have to somehow find rapport, some middle ground. This is a basic. And what the report said was basically, it was a litany of basically war crimes. Not the report, his oral account. So they forced, he told people about seeing 80-year-old men living in their own excrement in cells in Guantanamo. So what he did was they forced a meeting. Some of the people in the White House, over the bitter objections of the vice president's office and the general counsel's office, Gonzalez, they forced a meeting. Condoleezza Rice, who's basically useless, I'm sorry to say, with some decency, but very useless. Well, it's not an applause line, and it's not funny. It's just, you know, she's the national security advisor. And anyway, they forced a meeting, and Rumi came, and Cheney's office was there. The colloquy of the meeting was, we're talking about what they call a principal's meeting. She says to to Rumsfeld, look into this, I'll do it, and it disappears. And everybody in the White House and in the CIA who cared about this kind of stuff, and people in our government do. People who went through the Vietnam War, they saw the dehumanization. You know, racism is a powerful thing in our society. I mean, really, and people are aware of it. There are a lot of people who are aware of it. The way I always put it is I always say that the describing, you have to understand, for me, Vietnam equaled incredible racism. So I have a great sense of it firsthand. Bill Clinton always got my praise or my support because he was the first president, American president, since World War II to bomb white people. Think about it. In Kosovo. You know, that's... I mean, we're not a racist society. So they have... Nothing happens. Nothing happens. Here's the chronology. This is the fall of 2002, 6 months before Iraq. Iraq starts. The insurgency starts in September, October, August. The UN is blown up of last year, 2003. UN is blown up. The Jordanian embassy is blown up. Water pipelines, blah, blah, blah. It's clear. They begin talking publicly in the American government. Well, there's dead enders, as Rumi calls them, the insurgency. And maybe there's 5,000. We try and quantify the numbers. And the White House is in a panic about this. This I know. Rove's in a panic about it because it's a year before election time. My God, we can't have this around. We've got to get better intelligence on the insurgency. As one of the smart guys in the community said to me, the problem is we play chess and they play Go. We're way behind. It's very hard. And it takes a lot of thinking. And so one of the ideas, let's squeeze the prisoner population. These people picked up at roadside checks. And the way the prisoners were generated, a group of guys would be going along, Americans. A bomb would go off. Somebody would get hurt. The GIs would run into every nearby house and grab every male and arrest them. What do you know? Because the bomb went there. Somebody there should have seen something or known something. Throw them in jail where they're not categorized. They stay. And so the idea was, and there was an intellectual premise to it, too. The intellectual premise was, what happened? The intellectual premise was that the Israelis had had some success years ago, early on when they began the war against the Infantada, against the Palestinians. They had success in working in a counterinsurgency, grabbing people they knew to be leaders, stripping them, embarrassing them, getting them in embarrassed positions with photographs, homosexual, erotic, autoerotic pictures. In the Quran, a male is not supposed to be seen nude from in the front. And then telling them, go home, report for us, or we're going to spread these pictures all over your family and your friends. And, you know, shame, as I say, we operate in guilt, they operate in shame. And so the idea was, Rumsfeld had set up a secret commando unit 3 months after 9/11. And I'm sorry that it isn't in the daily newspapers or subject to debate, but what I'm telling you about is absolutely as empirical as I'm here. We set up a secret team because when all the countries began to offer help, initially to get somebody out of a country, somebody that was offered, let's say, by Sudan, you had to go through extradition. The American ambassador would have to get involved. There'd be a legal thing. Rumi couldn't stand that. And so with the president's approval, he set up a very exclusive unit, 20, 30 operators maybe, but a lot of support people inside the Pentagon in a restricted area known as a special access program, very secret program. They had to get approval from Congress. The president had to sign it off. It was briefed to a few select members of Congress who have told me about it for obvious reasons. I can't say which senators is going to talk to me about it because these are grave national security secrets. And the job of these guys was to disappear people like the Argentinians and the Brazilians did. And because of the fact that I told you I've known people for a long time who trust me because I don't always say everything I know, write everything. By early 2003, by May, June, there were papers generated inside Rumi's office called Manhunt. And Rumi was using the words. He was using the words in internal documents, top secret for his staff only, eradication. We're not out to arrest him, we're out to eradicate. I'm a very, you know, since the Wannasee conference, we haven't had that kind of language in a written document. But for me to write it would be to expose the person who gave it. Believe me, I'm not withholding. I just have to think about. The trust was, it doesn't matter. Anyway, the upshot is the secret team has been operating in our name of all of us, snatching people. Most of the time, they go to Egypt, where we do a lot of really nice handiwork. Although we believe in democracy, we seem to think the president that Musharraf and Mubarak represent the best there is to offer in democracy. That's sort of the wonderful ironies about our foreign policy. you wonder why people in the Arab world really have a hard time with us. We support Mubarak, we support Musharraf, we support the Saudi leadership, we support people that are antithetical to everything we say we stand for. And so you don't wonder why there's a lot of confusion about who we are and why it's so hard to mobilize support. Anyway, the team was brought in to Iraq over the objections of all the intelligence professionals at Rumsfeld's request with the approval of the White House, and they began to train people in the art of blackmailing. And the idea was you take prisoners who have nothing to do with anything, you put them into sexually humiliating positions, you photograph it, you send them home and tell them to join the insurgency and report back to us. That was the intellectual idea. It went and morphed into madness very quickly. And by September, late September, early October, the kids in the night shift, the kids from West Virginia, one of my sources said, one of the guys who told me about this said unkindly, the hillbillies from West Virginia, the Linda Englands, who her job, I think, before joining the reserves was night manager of a pizza parlor in some small town in West Virginia. We're talking about very rural people. And so it morphed into this. Within a month, the CIA, which is not prissy when it comes to being rough on people, got its people out of there at the highest level. Headquarters CIA said, get him out of there. This is going to blow up. I can't tell you that the CIA told anybody else in Washington about it. In any case, it goes on and on and on. The dogs, the stuff. And I've seen probably as much as anybody, hundreds of pictures. And Remnick, my editor at The New Yorker, we had a lot of debate about it. It comes down to people have seen what goes on. How much more do you want to humiliate the Arab mentality, Arab world? And we didn't publish a lot of stuff. And I don't fault them on that. Although in general, with the exception of a couple good editors, I do think most editors are mice training to be rats, but that's another issue. That's just where I come from. And so what happens is, here's the chronology. I'll get done with this and we can do some questions. The chronology is this. They're in trouble in Iraq because of the insurgency. In August, after the UN, they know it. They bring in the heavy guns. The special team is brought in. Over the objections, the special teams have been operating with Australian, Canadian, Jordanian passports. They've been out there. They've got their own Gulfstream 5s, their own helicopters. They get a report there's a bad guy somewhere. They go and they land and they check into the fanciest hotel. They get in the car that night, rent a car, go to his house, pull him up by his hair, go to an airport and fly him out. No extradition, no rendition, bomb. And if they don't work out, these guys, the rejects go to Gitmo. That's how the Gulfstream flies them to Gitmo. And the pattern of the plane is amazing. I've actually got a printout of where it went because somebody just did it for me. And it's amazing, you know. Gitmo, Dulles, Gitmo, Egypt. Let's try Singapore. The nice government there is very friendly to the idea of beating up people. Thailand was another spot where we did some interrogations. You say to yourself, you know, my parents came here from Eastern Europe to escape programs, or what you will, pogroms, and they came here, you know, the Statue of Liberty, because America meant something. America meant not only a fresh start, but freedom, morality. And who are these people in 3 years to take that away from all of us without a whimper? They've done it. They have. Well, and the idea is, in any case, just to finish the Kron stuff. So they're doing this horrible stuff. The CIA pulls out its people. The team is still there. They're training some of the military intelligence people. The kids get the back end of the stick, the night shift. These are all night stick kids. That's what they did at night, the pictures, to keep them. They were supposed to keep them awake at night, part of the interrogation technique, breaking them down. And so it goes on and on and on until one of the kids, a kid named Darby, one of the military policemen, just has enough of it, and he goes and he sends a CD and gives it to the military cops at Abu Ghraib. And the cops are straight. They're just like, cops love to get officers, and these cops were good cops, the CID, Army Criminal Investigation Division. Once they get the pictures, you got to act. The cat's out of the bag. This isn't just some allegations by Amnesty International, you know, goody-goodies or Human Rights Watch. This is it. They've got the photos. And, of course, they have a huge problem, which is, of course, the kids of today, they burn CDs all over the place. It's amazing to me more haven't come out. But in any case, so we know from the official, after the stuff I wrote, there was official explanations of what happened. This is about January 12th to 14th. Rumsfeld was briefed within 2 days. Interesting, because there's about 4,000 court-martial offenses a year, and he gets this one is important enough, so he gets briefed on it. He says he never looked at the pictures. He tells the president about it within a day or two, and nobody knew anything more about it until, boom, it hits in May. After May, they assign a new general. They start exclaiming, oh, my God. So the question I just don't understand why more people don't focus on it. What did they do from January until it came out in May? Nothing to stop, nothing to change anything. They did nothing. They hoped it would go away. They prosecuted the seven bad seeds, the seven guys photographed were the seven people being prosecuted. And so far, nobody else is being prosecuted, no other officer. The officers will get reprimands, as in the Vietnam My Lai case. They get reprimands. Callie, the only one who did any time, lieutenant, he served about 4 days at house arrest. And so there you are. It's just there in the chronology. I mean, well, did Rumsfeld know about Abu Ghraib and countenance? Of course not. It was appalling. He wouldn't have done anything. That's stupid. And what they were doing and all the photographing. But were the conditions set? Was from the very beginning, did anybody in this top of this government say at any point, boom, to the chain of command, you will not do this kind of stuff. You will not dehumanize, particularly people you have no idea whether they're guilty of anything or not. No. It's a moral failing. It's sort of a classic moral failing. And I'll tell you what a tough, nasty Israeli I know. One of those guys, that old-timer that knows Arabic and German and spent a lot of time crawling on his stomach in Damascus, I bet, in the 50s for Mossad. Anyway, he's just a tough old guy. And he said to me, Israelis can be very tough on prisoners, you know, individually. But he said, I've been killing and... I hate the Palestinians, and I've been killing them for 40 years, and they hate me, and they've been trying to kill me for 40 years. But I know somewhere, this is an email he sent me after I did those stories in May, but I know somewhere down the line we're going to have to share a border with those no-good sons of bitches, whether it's a border with a fence or not, we're going to have to share a border with them. And let me tell you, Hirsch, he said, if we had treated all our prisoners the way you treated them in Abu Ghraib, that can't happen. We wouldn't have been able to do it. It was only then I began to realize... we have dug a hole for ourselves. And so who can extract us from it? If I'm a conservative, I might want Kerry to win. The conservatives really don't like what's going on because they don't like the war and they don't like the economic, they don't like the budget deficits. But maybe this is a way to kill off the Democratic Party. Let Kerry win and ungovern with these guys biting at his knees, you know, all the time biting like fleas, the neocons, the Krautheimers of the world. Maybe that's the thing to do, because it's going to be very hard for the Democrats to pull it off in the next 4 years to do some... I would agree it's we have to try. On the other hand, if Bush wins, there's going to be a moment of epiphany. Might be 6 months, might be a year. At some point, the insurgency, I'm telling you, my friends on the inside say to me, they have frog missiles. They have short-range missiles, not with anything other than HE, high explosive. No, not chemical nuclear, and they don't have access to that stuff. But they are capable of causing more damage inside the green zone and inside military bases. That they're just choosing the way to escalate when they escalate. And so, as I said, president starts, he bombs, escalation, more casualties. It's going to, at some point, we're going to have to come face to face with a collapsing, failed policy. The Europeans, if Bush is elected, the Europeans have had it with him. We all hear it. I'll tell you exactly how I think it's going to play out. And this, I spent time, a year and a half ago, I'd go to Europe and I maybe see some intel guys and a foreign ministry guy. Now when I go to one of the major capitals, I see the head of intel and the foreign minister, I hear you're in town. They call my hotel, leave messages. And what do they want to know? I'm only exaggerating slightly. I mean it. What do they want? It's not that I want to know anything. They say, well, what do you know? Nobody talks to us. You know, we don't know what these guys are thinking. Tell me about these guys. What you can tell me about these guys? We don't know. And so what you have is the Europeans, I'm not going to say, I don't know what they'll do, not inside the UN, maybe inside the EU. Blair will probably win, but he's certainly softening. And you certainly are going to have the Europeans pulling together collectively against us. They're not going to tolerate 4 more years of Bush. And I'll tell you something else that's down the line that's coming. At some point, maybe the Germans even will do it. Schroeder's got an election coming. If he does better, he's got a woman rightist. If he does better against her and has a little more, feels a little stronger. Yeah, here's Germany. Germany's our ally since World War II. Like him or don't like the Germans. So are the French. Before before the invasion of Baghdad, we had Delta Force and SEALs and other special services. The Army has a special unit unnamed on Gray Fox, I think, is the code word last time I knew about it. They probably changed the code word since people like me learn about it. But they have a unit, undercover unit. They could be sitting, you know, guys totally, you know, they get a cell phone and said, meet somewhere, and they go to work. They're out in the world. And they were... Oh, you got to be kidding. Have you no shame, sir? You know, I've been out pimping this book for about a month, and I do a lot of network stuff. And you'd be amazed. I'd be with an NBC camera crew and the anchor in a live show, and the technician's beeper goes off. Everybody has to work through it, but it's amazing how it happened. Anyway, I think I can remember where I was. Oh, where was I? What? Oh yeah. Oh yeah, all these units. So the Germans, one of the things you have to know, we were inside Baghdad. Baghdad's got a big tunnel system, an underground system. And we were inside. We were inside the city, obviously. Yeah, that's what our guys do. Our guys get, you know, they get Iraqi passports and they grow long hair and they go in there and they work their way in. And the Germans are right with us, a special unit, because Germany had a great deal. They did a lot more trading and dealing with the Iraqis. And there's a very secret German commando unit that was with us. And not only that, all during the war, Germany provided signals intelligence coverage because we were so focused on Iraq. They covered everything from Iraq all the way into northern Europe. They diverted a lot of their assets, aircraft with monitoring and et cetera, tactical stuff to help us monitor. So the idea that they're not allies in the war, even though they disapprove of it, there's a longstanding relationship. And for Bush to go up and down in public like he did on them, and the same with the French. The French have a different kind of relationship with us on some very sensitive stuff that never stopped even during the war, because this is post-World War II stuff and, you know, collectively against the communists. So in any case, there's an enormous enmity in Europe towards us. And if Schroeder's reelected, and I'm telling you that the Europeans are going to get together and they're going to say to the United States of America, you are no longer going to be the interlocutor for the Israeli-Palestinian peace issue. You are not dependable. You can't do it. You're no longer trusted. You're no longer seen as fair. And they may move us out of that issue. I'm telling you, they want to do it. It takes an enormous amount of courage, particularly for a German to say that, given the heat they would get. But we're at that stage. We're going to see, if Bush is reelected, we're going to see enormous changes in the world that won't be to our benefit. We're going to be an isolated empire. And it's going to be the consequences. This is by far, what I'm saying doesn't, I hope it doesn't sound wacky to you, because it's not. I mean, there's going to be significant changes. Europe is not going to tolerate American bulldozing its way and putting everybody at risk. The national security, the threat of a Muslim uprising in Europe is much greater. They have huge minorities. They're much closer to the situation. Iraq's closer to them. The last thing they want is total complete chaos in Iraq. The last thing they want is somebody to do something stupid about Iran. Iran's nukes, if they have them, you're all convinced, you've all been convinced by the debate in the presidential base that Iran has gone nuclear. IAEA is not convinced. They're not sure. They think Iran's moved everything underground, covered up there. They have a lot of facilities covered up with hundreds of tons of sand on top of it. You can't bomb them out. And so what are you going to do? We missed our chance anyway. Before this war, the young kids in Iran were really posing a threat to the theocracy. We've now, with our stupid war, pushed Iran closer and closer, farther and farther away from any democratic reform that was looking to be probably possible. 3 years ago, the Israeli estimate was, we don't touch Iran because in 10 years it could be a much different country. Not anymore. It's changed. And this, another one of the consequences of this insanity that we have. And we're powerless in this, because this isn't being run on rationality. This is being run on a basis of misguided utopian ideology that isn't going to change. This president, as he said publicly, he told it to Woodward in one of those interviews, he said, even if I lose my reputation and my standing and the election, I'm going to proceed. He believes in this. He can't be, it's not about oil, it's not about day-to-day politics, it's about I don't know whether it's because he's a crusader or whether it's some religious belief, he believes in this. He's not going to be persuaded. The body bags, he will endure the body bags as a badge of honor. because if not now, and now they're talking 5, 10 years. I've heard some guys talk, maybe not in our lifetime. Iraq will be democratic. We will prevail. We must prevail. That's what we hear. And so no public outcry is going to stop it, except the military will fall apart. He may have to go to a draft. He may be confronted with a collapse of his own making. And that may be one way to rid ourselves of all of this, but it would be at a very high cost. And so we've got two options, it seems to me. We've got the Bush option of hoping for some epiphany. You'd have to use the draft. The Army's burned out. Special forces have burned out. They had a SEAL commit suicide the other week. I mean, the SEALs are operating 300. They have had 300 losses, 300 fewer SEALs than a year ago. As many as can get out. And that's for an elite unit like that is stunning and very demoralizing in the special forces community. The guys inside say they can't operate at this tempo for another year. And the reserves and the National Guard are done. The armed forces are done. The bombing. I've talked to pilots who are rotating so heavily into combat. I don't know why we ever see them or hear about the bombing. It's coming out of Qatar, most of it, I guess, and the Gulf. We don't even know where they're staged. No reporters have been there. It's a complete mystery where these planes come from. All you know is you read about airplanes bombing all day. Bombing all over the country. Where? Who? What? Where? What numbers? Anyway, I'll do questions. I have no uppers to dispense, but I understand this is totally depressing. What's the second alternative? Oh, yeah, Kerry. Kerry's elected. Maybe he doesn't get the Senate. Everybody worries about Kerry's elected. Maybe he gets, I don't know what's going to happen. There is an untapped reservoir. There's been an enormous amount of registration going on. In terms of George Soros and others have put up an extraordinary amount of money, and there's been a guy named Steve Rosenthal of the AAU. AAUW. If Gord won, this guy would be the hero because he got the vote out in Pennsylvania and Michigan. He would have been the hero. But Gord did win. But so if Gord had been named president. In any case... And so there is a huge, as one of the people involved said, there's 21 million unregistered unmarried women that they've been working hard at. So there's a lot of people the pollers don't get. So there may be a reservoir of a few points that we don't see. So he may win. But even so, if he wins, he probably won't have a Democratic House. He may get a Democratic Senate by one vote. It's going to be very hard to govern. It's going to be very difficult. The party's going to have a real bad time. It's going to be very hard. It's going to be very hard 4 years for this country. Very, very hard. We're not out of it even with a Democratic victory. We're not out of it. And so we've been put into a super hole, guys. And it's the most astonishingly serious, as you all know. And I sense it. I have a couple of doctor cousins who live up in near San Francisco who left their practice for a week to go to Nevada to register. And you hear those kind of stories all the time, people being active in politics that weren't active. There is a sense of it among the Democrats. But nonetheless, I'll tell you one last story, micro story, about the macro, just to add to the fun. I get a call. Guys in the field have numbers, phone numbers. They have phones, 800 numbers. They can call home, 800 numbers. A lot of parents have now gone to 800 numbers. And so guys can call. A lot of guys, some of the officers even have 917 or 914. It's a special area code set up. Which is strange because if you want to call the guy in the bunk next to you, you have to go internationally or dial local. It's an American exchange. So I'm not being casual about it because I don't know. I never know what to think about it. After Milai, I became the repository for almost every GI who witnessed something like that. And it's not illogical. And I've become sort of a reservoir for people with stories about this war. This is an officer. This is a call. I lose track of time going back and forth. 10 days ago, last Wednesday, a week ago Wednesday. He went to a good school, ROTC. Our Army paid for it and went into the Army. He's an officer, leads a platoon. He's in Iraq. He's in an Army unit that's bivouacked halfway between Baghdad and the Syrian border, a town. It's outside a town, which the mullahs have a lot of control, but the town is reasonably peaceful. The mullahs are running it. I guess you can call them the insurgency. But it's his guys are outside, and they get to be very friendly. They're not under any stress. They're just locked in a defensive position near a large granary. And I don't have all the details. I presume it's wheat. It's a large granary, and because there's been a collapse, a total collapse of any civil structure, the owners of the granary have hired locals to protect it. And you understand, when George Bush says there's 100,000 people willing to sign up for this Iraqi army, this magic army that's suddenly going to start doing what it can't, you have to understand that one of the things that the Bush administration did, Bremer's real job along with supervising the war, was to bring shock therapy to the economy. Listen up, I mean it. The idea was we were going to privatize all the socialistic and state-run enterprises in Iraq, and it was a very heavily, everything was state-run, Saddam controlled everything. They were going to privatize it. I think if it weren't for the pace of it, we'd be shocked at some of the people who were planning to make scores of millions of dollars doing so. But they broke down all the businesses and all the societies. They not only disbanded the army, they tried to disband and sell off most of the industry. And so what happened is there's no job base disappeared. One reason there's so much anger at foreigners in the beginning when they were ripping and knocking, blowing up things, not only was part of the insurgency, there were foreigners, Bangladeshis and others would be flown in to do the jobs Iraqis wanted to do. So there's no jobs. So they, of course they stand in line. They stand in line saying, okay, I know my chances of getting blown up now have increased tenfold, but I still, like anybody else, I want to take care of my family. $220 a month or 28 is a fortune in Iraq we pay. So they do go and line up. In any case, the insurgency's there. This guy, there's no jobs. So the people that owned the granary hired an untold number. I always thought in my mind it was about 30, two to three dozen guards. And this guy's platoon and the guards were all close to each other. And they became, Americans are really nice people. We all know that. And Iraqis are really nice people. We don't know that, but they are. Everybody in the anybody who's been in the Middle East, you know, you can't buy it. You can't give them anything. Whatever they have is yours. And that's cultural and profoundly true. All social strata, Sunni, Shia, it doesn't matter. And so they got friendly. Kids would share their stuff. And then came the orders from Washington, for political purposes, I guess. We've got to move, like we did in Samarra, we've got to clean out and start sweeping up the insurgency. You understand, when we go into Samarra and we win it, that means the insurgency leaves. We win, stay there a day or two, go out, and the insurgency comes back. That's what winning means. There's no win when you're dealing with a government that's there. Anyway, so the order comes to start doing something about the insurgency, and the next thing he knows, another platoon in his company comes over to his group's area and begin executing the guards one by one with rifle fire, long-range rifle fire. They start screaming. This guy's going nuts. What are you doing? He starts screaming. His guys start screaming. They can't get in the way of the fire. So he goes to the company commander, and the company commander says, essentially, you didn't see anything like that. We've got more kills. We've just killed 30 insurgents, and I've called it, and it's good for our company. You remember, we're seeing now the attacks, 150 insurgents get killed. Start thinking body count, folks. Remember the Vietnam body count? So what's he going to do? Wants to talk to somebody like me? He does. Horrified, just horrified. And maybe he's Pollyanna. But he said, before that, I'd never seen anything like that. I knew there were stories like that, but I'd never seen anything like that. They just shot people that were our friends. And you know advice I give him? Shut up. You've made your complaint to the captain. Your guys, the captain knows you think he's a war criminal. The guys in the other platoon know your guys think they're war criminals. It's a bad. Just finish your tour, get out of there, and shut up. You don't want anything. You've got nothing more to say. And boy, deja vu. Or as Yogi would say, all over again. So there we are. Let's do some questions. How do you want to do it?
Let's make a quick announcement.
The question and answer portion of this program can be heard on disc number 2.